Blog Talk Radio.
Open door, keep off shoes, drop the badge from umbrella to see it blink from across the room. Listen close, message sounds in the beat world upside down. Try to breathe, all air is gone. I know that you tried holding on for us. I hope that you know that I think you are strong.
And I wonder if you've ever noticed this before. You know, the positive people that puts out the positive music and the positive influence, they seem to last the longest. Have you ever noticed that?
You know, I don't know if I've noticed that, because I'm trying to think, like, because I think the person who's lasted the longest is Keith Richards. Is he positive?
Well,
I mean, I guess he has a positive outlook, but...
Well, most of those guys like him burned out a long time ago, though, you know what I mean.
You're absolutely right. Look, you know, I work diligently at my positive attitude, because the alternative is to just be unhappy, and that's not really how I want to spend my life.
And what do people, when you do a show, what's the most frequent reaction they have to your music? Do they say it uplifts them, or what's their comments usually?
I think the comment that I get most frequently was, I feel like you know me, because that song you sang perfectly captured how I felt about dot, dot, dot. And to me, that's the biggest gift that I get as a musician, you know, kind of feeling that validation, like, okay, you know, even if a show isn't as successful as I had hoped, or, you know, maybe we didn't pull in as much money this month, I still feel like the music has been sent to me for a purpose. And so that's a comment that sort of resonates, because it makes me feel like I'm on the right path.
Okay, here's a little secret about me that you don't know, but my listeners know. I've been known to write a few songs myself, and I kind of understand a little bit about the process. Of course, everybody's a little different, but do you ever get the feeling like, I didn't write that, somebody else wrote it?
All the time. I say that, you know, sometimes it's almost like, the only way I can describe it is, like, I feel like I sort of go into this trance-like state, because when I'm writing, time can pass, and, you know, maybe it'll be hours and I haven't eaten or seen the sun or gone outside or even moved, you know, from the instrument, and then all of a sudden there's this song in front of me, and I'm like, you know, I try to retrace my steps, and I think that sometimes I want to record the process just to, like, really see how it happens. And I do that to some extent using my iPad. I'll kind of record audio as I get ideas and keep the, you know, the iPad going. But I'd be really curious to see how, if I videotaped, like, what the like, if I actually was still there, or if, like, I got lifted away and, like, some other little being showed up, wrote the song, and then put me back.
Yeah. And do you ever get, like, when you're writing something, do you ever get really excited, like, oh, this is good, this is really, really good, you know, and you get really hyped up about it, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, I mean, honestly, my process is, I'll get this sort of itchy feeling on my legs and my arms, like where I literally physically itch, and I'm like, oh, I think this is something good. And then I'll go into the self-doubting mode where I'm like, oh, I don't know if it's that good. And for me, the first step is, I always play it for my husband, John DeMauro, and get his reaction, because he hasn't been, you know, messing with it all day long the way I have. And so once I see and hear his reaction, then I trust my instincts a little more. Like, if he says, wow, that's really great, then I'm like, oh, okay. Maybe
right.
This is a keeper, you know. But if he doesn't have that reaction, then I go back to the drawing board and try and tweak it a bit.
What about in your sleep? Do you ever get a song idea in your sleep and wake up and have to get it down on something?
Well, I mean, I think every creative person has that, you know, time when they start getting the best song they've ever written, or at least they think so, in their dream, and they wake up and they're like, but I'm so tired, I don't want to go get the pad and the pen, I'll remember it, it's so strong, and then of course it's gone the next morning. So, you know, now of course I have a pad and pen in my nightstand next to the bed, and I don't think I've had that sort of experience since I put the pad there. It's probably,
you know,
like this,
funny,
like,
what I have happened funny to me is, I'll wake up and I'll go, I can't write that down, that's stealing it from that guy in my sleep.
Ah, see?
Same kind of thing as not wanting to write it down, I guess, sound, you know, that same deal there. I was going to ask you, too, when you got started, when you were, how young, what age were you when you started doing musical things?
Well, my mom and dad tell me that I was always musical. Like, even before I learned how to walk, they'd put music on and I would just start, like, bopping and dancing from a seated position. And we actually have video proof of that. So it really did happen. They're not just parents remembering me, you know, far more talented than I was, you know. The interesting thing is that as a little kid, I desperately wanted a piano, and we lived in an apartment when I was young, and there was no room, and I don't know that my parents really had the means to buy a piano at that point. So it wasn't until I was 15 that I actually got one, but before I got the piano, they were able to get me a guitar. And the funny thing is that I think that most kids, their inclination when they get their first instrument is to learn the stuff that they hear on the radio. And I was weird. I mean, from the first moment that I got that guitar, my first impulse was to write songs. And, you know, as a kid, I remember thinking, like, I am really good at this. Like, I can do this. And, you know, of course, the older I got, the more uncertain I got about it. You know, there's, like, something about being a child where you have this confidence that, I don't know, that somehow escapes us as grown-ups. Or at least for me, it does.
Yeah, and also, I noticed when I was a kid, a lot of times I used, back when we were younger, I think kids used their imagination more. I'm not trying to down anybody, but these days everything's so easy to find, you know, and you don't really have to use your imagination. You can just go on a computer or whatever, tablet or whatever, and find it.
It's a very different world. I remember hanging out with my nephew when he was little and saying to him, you know, I want to see more than the top of your head. I want to see your face every now and then, because he was always playing his Xbox, you know. And I thought, like, this is so sad, because I want to make sure that not only that I experience him at this age, but that he builds memories at that age, you know, that he's got things going on in his life that are going to leave an imprint more than a game of Xbox ever could. And I'm thankful that my sister always encouraged him to go out and play and to be creative. And I think that most parents these days are a little fearful of the technology. I think that in some ways it's sort of a lifesaver, because if you're trying to get work done, and I think the difference is that most parents today, like, you know, it's very rare that you find a household where it's not a two-parent working household. And, you know, you've got work to do all day long, and you've got work to do when you come home, and what do you do with your kids? Well, you know, you plop them down in front of the television, or you put them on an iPad. And I think that, especially even long car drives, I get that. That's sort of a lifesaver, that it frees you up to do your life when you've got kids. But at the same time, I think that parents have become very, very sensitive to the fact that their kids are experiencing the world through this alternate reality instead of, you know, our real 3D world, as I call it, and a place where you can turn a box into a fort and you create a scenario based on that fort. I think that most of the parents that I know have been really encouraging their kids to explore outside of their smartphone or their, you know, whatever little device it is that they like to play with, because they want them to have those experiences of imagination and creating something that's not there, you know?
Yeah. I was reading a little bit about you today on your bio and stuff, and I was real curious about Ritchie Blackmore, and I know he was with Hard Rock stuff, and I read where you were in his group for a while, but it wasn't a hard rock group. Could you explain that?
No. Yeah, no, I definitely wasn't in the hard rock group. You know, Ritchie is a very, very interesting, legendary guitar player, first of all. One of the greatest rock guitar players, I think, that has ever been on the planet, if not the best. But he's a really interesting character in that, you know, I know that he's had many, many opportunities to do reunion tours with Rainbow and Deep Purple, and I'm guessing it would have amounted to millions and millions of dollars. And he is very, very committed to doing his folk renaissance, the music that really inspires him. And I think it's remarkable that you have somebody whose hunger is more about the creativity and the music than the money. You know what I mean? Like, I think that it's so easy to get swallowed by rock stardom, and you come to, you know, just go where the money is rather than where your heart takes you. And the one thing I'll say about him is that, you know, against probably every, you know, music reporter's opinion and every business person in the music industry's opinion, he's stuck to his guns and done the music that he's passionate about, which is folk renaissance. And he's done quite well with it. I mean, the group is Blackmore's Night. That's who I toured with. I was actually in the band as a backup vocalist. I also played incidental keys. And I also was the support act, which was one of the greatest musical gifts anybody has ever given me. You know, when he was auditioning me for the band, And it's a long, long, long involved story, but essentially, you know, his manager had stumbled upon me and really liked what I was about, but she's like, you know, I have to introduce you to Richie, you know, if I'm going to help you, you know, I gotta get him on board. And so, you know, after a series of auditions, he said to me, you know, my main concern for you is that you're a solo artist, and how is it going to be going out on the road, you know, playing in another band and not doing your own music? So before I even could answer, he said, what about if I let you open for the band? And I was absolutely flabbergasted because I thought to myself, here's this guy who, you know, he's a legend and he's got, you know, fans all over the world. He does not have to do me, this little fledgling independent artist, any favors. And yet he so generously offered me this opportunity, and I guess I wasn't really taking in what that meant when I said yes, because my very first time opening, I walked out on stage to play solo, just me and my keyboard, and there were 10,000 people in the audience, you know, and for someone who had been, you know, I had a reasonably successful career, but I had never played in front of 10,000 people by myself before. It was kind of shocking. It definitely was a wake-up call to, like, well, either I'm going to sink or swim here. And, you know, I feel like the audience was so welcoming, and I think that they instinctively knew I wouldn't be opening for him if I didn't have that kind of stamp of approval. So they listened, and it was one of the most magical experiences of my entire career, you know.
Also, I was noticing on the YouTube looking and seeing some of your videos, and also seeing where you were on the Regis and Kathy Lee. And
yeah.
Would you consider that one of your career breaks, or what would you think? How did that do?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, look, you know, that was an instance where, you know, ironically, I had never seen the show before I was actually on it, because I'll confess here, I'm not a morning television person. I probably would like it later in the day, but when I wake up in the morning, I am in quiet mode. That's one of the few times during the day that I don't want to talk. I don't want to hear talking. I just kind of want to do my journal writing and meditate and go for my run and then start my day. So the first time I ever saw the show was when I was on it, and, you know, they kind of let me know, well, there's 10 million viewers that watch the show every morning. So, you know, you want to talk about terrifying. I mean, I was shaking so drastically when I got behind the piano, and as nice as everybody was, there's just that idea that this is not only live, but it's going out to 10 million people, and if I make a mistake, 10 million people are going to see and hear it. So it was pretty exhilarating and terrifying at the same time. And was it a career break? Of course. I mean, it opened doors for me. I think I sort of nailed the Blackmore's Night gig because of the, you know, the appearance on Regis, and you know, I wound up getting a booking agent, and, you know, a whole bunch of things spiraled in a good direction after that.
Also, I noticed, I was reading that you had quite a few, like, movie and television show placements, and how do those come about? What's the process on those? Just a typical one, for an example.
Well, you know, so much of my life is happenstance, and I have to say that the very first soundtrack placement that I got was just sheer luck. I had written a couple of songs with another songwriter named Meryl Matthews, and a friend of hers wound up producing a show called Are You Afraid of the Dark, which was a really big kids show. I think it was in, I don't know if it was like the early 90s. And, you know, she contacted me and she's like, well, you know, they want to use these songs for the show. And I was like, great. And I didn't really think much about it at that point, but then I got the checks and I was like, wow, I should definitely do more of this. And so then I started to more actively pursue it. And, you know, I aligned myself with a music library and did really well with them for some time, and, you know, reached out to some music supervisors on my own. And, you know, yada, yada, yada. You know, it seems like in any industry, but particularly in the entertainment industry, once you get that one break, other people are more willing to listen to you. So I think that the Are You Afraid of the Dark gig kind of opened doors, because it was like I could now knock on a door and say, well, you know, I'm one of the songwriters who had, you know, soundtrack placement in Are You Afraid of the Dark. Oh, okay, well, we'll listen to your stuff. And so that's kind of how that happened.
What's the royalty, excuse me, what's the royalty structure like that? Do you get paid, I know you get paid for first run, and do you get paid the same amount for like a reruns, or how does that work?
You know, it's changed a lot. I mean, it depends on what country it's being played in and on what type of station. You know, here's the thing, with music placement, you get a licensing fee first, and that comes directly from the production company. So whether it's a movie producer or a television production or a commercial, they're going to pay you a set licensing fee that gives them the right to sync your composition to their moving picture, okay? And there's two licenses. There's a sync license, and then there's a master use license. So one covers the composition, and the other covers the recording of that composition. After that, the royalties happen based on, like I was saying, what kind of station. If it's cable, it's paid at this rate. If it's network, it's paid at this rate. If it's network at prime time, that's the highest paid on network. You know, there's afternoon network, there's morning network. You know, they all have different fee schedules. And then depending on if there is reruns, when the rerun happens will determine how your royalties come about. So, you know, if you keep getting primetime network reruns, then yeah, you're going to get those royalties at the same rate over and over again, but you're not going to get another licensing fee unless you have like a deal where it says, okay, well, this is on cable, but if it gets by a network, you'll get a secondary, you know, fee at this level. You know what I mean?
Okay, what about the movies? How does that work? Is it based on just one fee, or is it like how many theaters to show in, or how many times it's run, or how does that work?
You know, I've only had one placement in a movie, and actually, I'm sorry, that's wrong. I had two placements in a movie, and one of them went to festivals but never got into distribution, and the second one never even got into festivals. So honestly, other than getting the upfront fee, I don't know the answer to that question. I would guess that there's going to be, you know, some sort of royalty from the PRO, which is your performing rights organization. I've been aligned with CSAC for decades at this point. I think they're the most wonderful performing rights organization on the planet. They take such good care of me. They're very hands-on. They're very, very involved with me as an artist and me as a songwriter. And so I would think, because they collect royalties anytime music is performed, that yes, I'm thinking that movie theaters probably pay some sort of licensing fee, or maybe it's the movie production company or the movie distributor that pays the fees. But I would think that every time the movie is shown in a theater, there would be some sort of fee. And then I would think that if it's, you know, say the movie then winds up on television, like HBO buys the right, I'm sure that they pay some licensing fees also, some royalties, not licensing fees.
Okay. Would you like to give out your website and information and all that right while we're thinking about what I'm thinking about it before we forget?
I would love to. Yes, absolutely. You can find me at marcygeller.com, and I'm going to spell it because there's a lot of different ways to spell Marcy and Geller. So it's marcigeller.com. And that's my home base. From there, you can pretty much find everything. If you sign up for my mailing list, you'll get the newsletters letting you know if I'm going to be playing near you, when new music is released, anything that I think of to talk about. And also, if you're more of a social media type of person, you can easily connect with all of my social media right from my website. It has my Facebook music page. It has my Twitter page. It has my Instagram, my new favorite addiction, which is Periscope. So all that stuff can be found on my website.
Okay, I know it's something else. While I was looking around on your website, I see where you have it. Like, I don't know if it's weekly or how often you have chats. Like, you know, what do you do on your chat? Talk about your music, or what do you talk about?
You know, I talk about a lot of different things. You know, inevitably people ask questions about the music, but I really try to make the topics more universal so that people who are not musicians who are tuning in can sort of connect with them. So I've been doing them every Monday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, and they happen on my website. It's marcygeller.com/videos. If you go to my homepage, if you don't want to write down a million different websites, you can just go to my homepage and it'll have a link right there that tells you where the web chats happen. And it's called #SquarePegChat because it's named after the newest CD called Square Peg, which you are one of the first DJs on the entire planet to play one of the tracks out there. So thank you. That song Strong came from that album. Last night, the topic that I talked about was how do you stay motivated towards your passion? And it was a really lively discussion because I had musicians that were on the chat, but I think I also had people that were not musicians who were listening in, but still people with passion. And we talked about the different things that, you know, drive us and the things that detour us and how to keep motivated, especially when passion, you know, at times can center around something that you need to be self-motivated about. So, like in my instance, it's the music. I have to maintain a level of self-motivation to keep my music out there because I'm not signed to a major label. I am the label. You know, I'm partners with my husband, and we have an independent label with distribution, but we still have to do all the work. And so for that reason, I'm always looking for healthy ways to stay motivated about my passion for my music. And so we talked about it, and it was really interesting because people had different points of view about it and about how they manage the self-motivation aspect of being a creative person. So that's kind of what we do. So yeah, tune in on Monday nights. Again, it's marcygeller.com/videos, 8 o'clock Mondays Eastern Time, and it's a little over a half hour only because Ustream does put some commercials in there, and I like to give everybody the full half hour, and I will usually sing a song somewhere in that half hour, so you do get a performance. And I think it's been, I've really been enjoying them. It's been a lot of fun, and it's been sort of inspiring for me because I've had to think about, like, what do I want to share with the world this week?
Okay, now there's one thing I've noticed since I've been, like, in the radio and writing songs and stuff, you know. Of course, I haven't had any commercial success, as you might say. It's actually been going the other way, but I know there's a lot of people out there, and it really kind of, I don't want to get too upset, but it ticks me off a little bit when the first question they ask you, and I'm sure you've had this ask of you before, I don't know how they ask it, it might be nicer to you, but how much money have you made off of that? Or have you made any money off of that? If you haven't, you're no good, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, that's an interesting statement because, you know, I used to make quite a nice sum of money making music. And I do see as our technology changes and access to music is so easy nowadays, I do see a decline in physical sales of CDs. But rather than getting disheartened about it, I've just decided to, you know, like any business person, I have to reassess where I'm at, where I want to be, and how do I get there. So the web chat was one of the things that I designed on purpose because I genuinely want to engage people who and get them interested in me as an artist and as a person, because the music is so easy and readily available. So, you know, I think you have to add other facets to yourself to be compelling to people these days. I also have had many heart-to-hearts with myself about, you know, how do I define success? Is it X amount of dollars? Is it this number on a chart? Is it this many people liking a post? Like, what is success to me? And I've come to the conclusion that success is feeling good in my own skin and still feeling like I'm doing good work. And musically, I think I'm in my best space that I've ever been. So I think the work is just getting better as far as I'm concerned. And as long as I can keep a roof over my head, I'm going to just let the money stuff figure itself out and not qualify, you know, not judge my level of success based on a number.
Right. Well, I kind of base my success on, you know, playing the best music I can. And like we were talking before, there's some music out there that's just kind of real thrown together, you know. People can get a little bit of that and throw it together. I don't play that kind of music, you know.
Right. Yeah, well, we were talking about how anybody could be a recording studio. You need, like, a couple of microphones and a, you know, GarageBand on your computer, and you're good to go. But I don't know. You know, there are things that I've learned throughout my life, and I definitely have always had a very high expectation of what I expect out of myself musically. But what I have learned truly is that, you know, other people are not holding that same standard. People want to be moved somehow. And I think that people are moved by the truth. And I'll tell you a very, very short story. When I first started out, my very first record deal was for what they called a 12-inch deal, and it meant that they put a 12-inch record, and I seriously mean record, like, you know, vinyl, and it was like one song that they did five different mixes of, and it went out to DJs and to clubs and the whole bit, and you did the tour. So that was my first record deal, and I remember I was opening up for this artist, and I'm not going to name him because I remember thinking, I can't even believe this guy is famous because he can't even sing in tune. I mean, I could not wrap my head around why this guy was so hugely successful. And I, you know, as a musician who had been schooled, I knew he wasn't even singing in tune. And meanwhile, there I was doing this dance music, which is not really where my passion and my heart was, but I did it because I sort of got talked into it, you know, like, you're cute, you can dance, we can do something with this. And so, voila, add water mix, I was a dance artist. Well, so long story short, I show up at the venue to open up for this artist, and the lines are literally wrapped around a city block. Like, that's how many people had been standing in line to see this guy, and I'm just, like, rolling my eyes thinking, you know, really, like, this guy, okay, whatever. So I do my opening spot, and it goes really nicely, and he introduced himself, and happened to be very sweet, and he's like, please stay and watch my show, and I did. And as soon as I saw him perform, the light went on, and I went, okay, now I get it. And I realized in that moment the reason that all these people had waited in line for that long in the cold weather was because this guy believed every word that came out of his mouth when he was singing. It was complete and total authenticity. And I think that audiences can smell it, can breathe it, can taste it. I think that an audience knows when you're the real deal. And if you're the real deal as a dance artist, then you're gonna attract all of the real deal dance, you know, fans. If you are the real deal singer-songwriter, I think that you're going to attract all the real deal singer-songwriter fans. And so from that was a really important lesson for me, because I decided at that point that success was not what I was striving for. Authenticity was what I was striving for. And so I stopped playing by the rules. I stopped doing what I was supposed to do as an artist, and I started making music that was honest. And, you know, I'm not a household name, but I think that the people who love me and who love my music genuinely are loving the real person. And for me, I guess I just defined success for you. That is success.
Well, I can give you kind of an example from the audience standpoint. Back in 1976, there was a little guy running around, and back then he was literally a little guy. His name was Bruce Springsteen.
Okay.
I went and seen Bruce Springsteen, and I lived in Louisiana then, and he was playing a place that held maybe 3,000 people, but there was maybe like 400 people there. And the next day I went and told all my friends, I said, oh, you missed the best concert there ever was. They said, who? I said, Bruce Springsteen. They go, I never heard of that guy. I go, you will.
You will, yeah.
Promise
yeah.
you will. I know
yeah.
music. I wasn't doing nothing with music back then, but I knew music, good music when I heard it. And that guy put on a show. I mean, he was jumping into the audience and dancing around like you were talking about, just going crazy, you know.
Yeah.
There was a person that walked out of that place that didn't have a big smile on their face and, you know, was just as happy and just felt like they got their, of course, back then the concert was like $8, but you got your money's worth.
Right. Yeah, no, I bet you did, and that's a perfect example, you know, and it's interesting that you say that because, like, to me, 400 people in an audience would be monstrous these days. I'd love to sing for 400 people, but I know what you're saying. Like, when an arena holds 3,000 and there's only 400, it feels like it's empty.
You want to hear the really funny part about it? 9 years later, after he was a household name, of course, in 1985, well, he was on tour. And he was going to Dallas, and there was a bunch of people in Shreveport, Louisiana, that tried to get a petition up to get him to come to Shreveport. And I went down to the newspaper, and I told him, I said, look, he's not coming to Shreveport. And they go, why not? I said, I'll tell you why. Here's a poster from his 1976 concert. I was one of the few hundred people that was there. Why would he come back to a place like this that did not support him when he started out? He's not going to do it. And they put me in the newspaper with the poster beside me showing proof because people were saying, he's never been to Shreveport. I said, yes, he has. He did not support the man, so why would he waste his time now when he can sell out a 20,000, 30,000 seat place and come here for 7,000 or 8,000?
Well, I mean, and that's what's so interesting about it is because, you know, I have found that it's a really interesting phenomenon when in the United States an unknown band becomes known, especially if they're not on a label. If they're on a major label, they obviously have tools and outlets that us little guys don't have. But the interesting thing is that in Europe, it's very different. You know, I remember having a conversation with a friend in Switzerland, you know, and she was saying, well, why don't you play any festivals over here in Switzerland? And I'm like, well, they'd never book me. They'd never heard of me before. And she's like, what are you talking about? It's all new music. She said, how else would you find new music to listen to if you didn't go to a festival where you didn't know who the artists were? And I said, wow, that's like exactly the opposite of the way I think most people in the United States think.
Yeah, that's why you have the guys that's around, like we were talking earlier about Keith Richards and the people like that that's been around forever, because that's what people want to hear, something they know. Yeah.
Yes, and I get that. I really do, and I respect that. But I also, I as an artist, I always listen for something different. Like, I don't want to go hear cover bands. I want to hear new music that I've never heard before. And I'm kind of hoping that maybe I have some sort of infection and it'll be contagious and more people will get it. Because I think that when you open yourself up to music that you've never heard before, okay, maybe it's not familiar now, but maybe someday it is going to be familiar and you'll have that memory of, I was one of the first people to hear that, you know? I mean, I don't know. I think music, like, marks time for us. It's the soundtrack to our lives, and I think it would be neat to be able to say, like, well, I saw this band before they were anybody, and I knew that they were great, just like you were just telling your story, and be able to, like, then see them become something because you tell everybody you know, that you love this band, and then all of a sudden they start having a name, and you can kind of feel like a connection on a deeper level because you were integral to that band getting to where they are at that level of success, you know?
Right, and that's kind of what I'm doing with my radio. I got two radio stations. I don't know if you're familiar with Live 365.
Sure.
Okay, I have a Live 365 station, and then I have this Blog Talk station. And on the Blog Talk, in the last 3 years, I've had like 150,000 listeners, and that's all indie, unknown bands most of the time playing, you know, to help. I'm trying to help, you know, I'm not getting anything out of it, but just I like to help people that's, you know, like you said, to get heard, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that's a gift. I mean, I think that's a gift that you're providing for other people. And it's interesting, you know, when I was little, I remember my dad used to come home all excited, and he'd say, this is the next big thing, you know, and it would be some artist. And I remember, like, being really little and him coming home with a Carly Simon record and him saying, she's the next big deal. And I don't think he ever saw the record again after that because I absconded with it into my bedroom and just played it over and over again until I wore the grooves out.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, like you said, I don't know what's. I just imagine what it would be like if you were in one of those bands that's been playing like the same songs for like 40 whatever years. Don't you think you'd
yeah.
get kind of bored? Wouldn't you get kind of bored? I mean, kind of.
Well, that's a really good point because I'll tell you something. I went to see an artist once who's very, very famous, and everybody was screaming for her to do her big hit. And she could not have been more apathetic. I mean, she literally just, like, sighed and rolled her eyes through the just to get through it. And I'm sitting there in an audience, you know, position saying to myself, how dare she? Because what would I give to have a song that everywhere I went, everybody wanted to hear it, you know, like I'd give like my left arm or something just to have that experience once in my life, you know. So I kind of found it sort of upsetting. I think that if you're a band and you've been playing the same songs for 40 years and that's all they want to hear from you, well, you know what? Be thankful that they want to hear something from you and then go out as a different band and play the new songs that you want to play, I guess. I don't know.
Here's a funny thing
about
it. Or
go to Europe.
Here's a funny little story kind of like that. Me and this guy wrote a song. I wrote the lyrics. He did the singing and the music on it. It was called Emptiness. And it was a country song, and it's just like a guitar and very spare music behind it. But anyway, he didn't tell me, but he put it on SoundClick. This is back like in 2005, I think it was, or somewhere around 2005 or 6. Anyway, he didn't tell me he put it on SoundClick, and then he sent me an email one day, and he goes, go over to SoundClick and look for our song. And I looked over there, and there was like, I think it was like 4,000 songs in the what they call the classic country, because that's kind of what it sounded like. There was 4,000 songs in there, and guess where we were at?
Where?
Number 8. And that's no
wow.
push.
Wow. Good for you.
About it. He didn't push it. We weren't on the internet begging people to vote or any of that stuff. It just did it all by. And to me, that's worth more than you sitting there trying to get all your friends and whatever to vote for something. I don't think that's real, you know.
Yeah,
I agree with you. But the people like the general public. And I've had stuff on the radio before, and I had stuff on regular radio stations, and people were calling in and requesting it, you know,
yeah.
that I wrote.
Well,
I
agree with you. Yeah, that has a lot more impact.
It's made me feel good, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I personally, I have a tough time with competitions, you know, like I'm not a competitive person by nature. So, you know, any of these things, like they ask you, oh, you know, you just have to get in, you know, pay $35 and, you know, and then get all your friends to vote for you and maybe you can win this publishing deal. I'm like, no, this is not what I want to do.
Those are what I call big ripoffs. But I wrote a little, me and a friend of mine wrote, there was, my brother-in-law, he was a big fisherman up there in the lakes, Livingston, north of Houston, like 75 miles. And he came out with the story that he said he thought there was a 1,000-pound catfish in that lake. Of course, it was a big exaggeration. But anyways, we took it and ran. We took it and ran with it. We wrote a song called Mr. Big Mouth. And do you know we got that song in the Houston Chronicle article of 1.5 million circulation on the Channel 11 CBS channel in Houston, Texas? And we also got it on about three different Houston radio stations. And the funniest part is I used to work at the Union Pacific Railroad, and I was working in the diesel shop, which works on the engines. And I started writing poetry and stuff back in about 1993, and those guys were merciless on me. You know, oh, you're stupid. Oh, poetry, who cares? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's one morning I came in, and I said, oh, have you looked at the newspaper today? They go, yeah, we looked at the newspaper. What about us? I don't think so, because look at that half-page article in there about a song I wrote. And then they really got, I really kind of ticked them off, you know, because they wanted to, they couldn't stand for somebody to have a little success. And then the next morning I said, hey, your favorite fishing show that comes on every morning, why don't you turn it on this morning? So they turned it on, and guess what was on there? My fishing song.
Uh-huh.
My cat song was on there. And boy, they didn't like that at all either. So I really kind of, that was better than any kind of money I could have got, because I got to look at their faces and watch them just turn green. Yeah, it was really cool.
Oh, good for you. Yeah, well, good for you. That's excellent.
It's a hostile, what you would call a hostile environment, you know, which is kind of what I was incubated in, more or less, you know, for 23 years. But I didn't,
yeah.
The reason I don't work there anymore is because I have a little health problem called multiple sclerosis. So
oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I don't really have, I was in 1997, I got diagnosed, and I really don't. You know, we were talking earlier about music. I really don't have time to mess with anything but the best, if you know what I mean. Because
I don't have
that much. I mean, it's just too precious to me, the time and the effort and everything. It's not worth it to just put halfway done music or people that don't care or whatever you want to call it on the radio.
Right, right. Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because I do think that there's something to be said for, you know, appreciating every moment and making really good choices about how you spend your time on this planet. You know, and as much as I'm sad to hear that you're struggling with a disease like MS, I also know that it adds perspective that perhaps you didn't have before. Maybe you did. I don't know. Maybe you're just
stuff that people, that other people don't notice, I notice. You know, because they're in too big a hurry, and I don't get in that big a hurry. I don't know if you're going to do that or not, but I'm kind of slow, like everything to me is kind of in slow motion while they're speeding it up triple time, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm watching things develop, like, okay, I saw that. You didn't see that, but I did. Now, you missed that. I saw that, and I'm going to write about this that you didn't know. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, and you're in the South also, right? Am I correct?
Yeah,
in that?
I'm also in, and I'm also in about 10 months a year air conditioning too, because I can't take the heat.
Yeah, I hear you. Well,
because
I was gonna say, like, I know that up here in the North, like, there's like this perception. I think that Southerners sometimes think that the Northerners are sped up, and that the Northerners think the Southerners are slowed down. And it's like, I'm always like, I think I would love the opportunity, or the ability is a better word, to slow down everything, my perspective and the way I take in the world. You know, I think there's something to be said about stopping and.
Yeah, I think where a lot of that speeding up came from is trying to keep warm, and where that slowed down is down here is trying to stay cool, because when it gets hot, you're not getting that big a hurry, you know.
Yes, I think that definitely has something to do with it. I think you're absolutely right. And, of course, see, maybe that's the problem, is maybe I was born in the wrong place, because I am always freezing. Like, everybody can be sweating, and I'm, like, putting a sweater on, you know. So I think that the South calls me sometimes.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't be needing a sweater down here until about December and January, maybe February, and by March you'd be probably taking the short sleeves again, you know.
Yeah. I don't think that would bother me one bit.
Yeah, you'd just be trading in a heating bill for air conditioning bill, probably, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
But I heard the heating bills are pretty bad sometimes.
They're like a small rent, you know. It's like, I feel like like we're paying a rent payment to our oil company up here sometimes, but they apparently the oil prices have gone down, and not good. We haven't had to turn the heat on yet up here, which I'm happy and thankful for. So I'm hoping that stays the course, so I can save some money.
Okay, I was looking. I think I got all your songs downloaded here on the show from your new CD. Which one would you like me to play next, and I can kind of find it real quick?
Why don't you play? Let's play "Save Me." It's a duet with the fabulous, legendary Lori Lieberman. It's the lead track on the CD, and I think it sort of has become my motto of sorts.
Okay, now how did you two happen to work together? Did you write with her, or how does that work?
I actually wrote the song on my own, and I knew that I heard another voice on it, and I could have just gone into the studio and put it on myself, but I really wanted to add a different dimension, and Lori and I became friends a few years ago, and she's just the most wonderful person, and I don't know, I just had this, like, inspiration. I said, look, the worst thing that'll happen is if I ask her, she can say no. So I asked, and she loved the song, and she lives in L.A., so she has a recording studio at her place, so I sent her the tracks that we had already done, and she laid down her vocals in L.A. and sent it to me through the internet, and voila, we had a duet, and it was just magical.
Okay, well, let's play it now. It's Save Me with Lori Lieberman featured here.
Mm-hmm.
Just outside my window, there's a world that's shining brightly, but the only thing that strikes me are the shadows. I can ride the waves of goodness, let my body float on hope, push aside the constant clamor of myself down. I searched high, I fell low, lost my savior long ago. So I know that it's the music that will save me. Marvel at the beauty behind this tattered shirt that reminds me of the moment when my face drew. But the truth is just an angle that could turn like billow sail, and the only one to steer it holds the money. I searched high, I fell low, lost my savior long ago. Now I know that it's the music that will save me. Pull the curtain back and behold the promise of my creation.
Sound kind of weird because I can't remember the lady's name, and I really feel bad because I interviewed her about 4 or 5 years ago, and she wrote, but I'll tell you what she's written. She wrote that song, Helen Reddy, That Ain't No Way to Treat a Lady.
Okay.
And your songwriting style and even your singing reminds me of her a whole bunch.
Well, now I'm going to have to Google her.
Yeah, because, I mean, she's really pretty famous, I think. She does a lot of songwriting. She has songwriting classes, stuff she does out in Los Angeles. And she's an actress and a couple of other things that she does, too. And I can't remember her name, but she's a real nice...
I got it. I looked it up. Harriet Shock.
Yeah, Harriet Shock, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I'd love to write for Helen.
You might want to do something with her or something. I don't know, but you guys sound a lot alike. If you listen to some of her music, you can probably hear a lot of your stuff in there, you know, that you've...
Cool.
I don't know. I thought maybe she might even be an influence on you because you guys have a lot of a similar, you know... I guess I have a soft spot for the singer-songwriters that don't really have a lot of the bang, boom, boom go on, you know? That's more
lyric.
Yeah, I like the lyric-driven stuff, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, that's interesting. No, I've never heard of her before, but that doesn't mean that I wouldn't, you know, want to meet her or talk to her. Who knows? You know, it's very, very interesting that you say that. And the thing that's funny about you saying that is that I have found throughout my life that people will say, you know who you remind me of? And it'll always be somebody that to that point I had never heard of before. And then I'll go listen and go, really? Okay, I like this, but I don't think I sound like this. And it's happened to me so many times in my life. I mean, I remember for a long time, many people when I was younger was telling me I sounded like Laura Nero. And I'm like, who's Laura Nero? And, you know, I finally, you know, had a publicist was like, shame on you. How do you not know who Laura Nero is? And she gave me, like, her entire collection to go home and listen to. And I was like, I don't sound anything like this woman. She's great, but I don't sound like her. And she said to me, no, you don't sound like her. You make me feel the way she used to make me feel when I used to go see her. And I was like, oh, that's a great compliment.
How about Carole King? You ever get that comparison?
Constantly. And again, the funny thing is that when I was a kid, I didn't discover Carole King until I was older. I listened to Carly Simon. So it's interesting to me that the people I've been compared to or said that I sound like have not been the influences. And I'm almost kind of happy about that because I don't ever want to feel like I'm plagiarizing or stealing from another artist. You know what I mean? But it's fascinating that somehow there's this common thread that connects musicians, and we may not even be aware of one another, but somehow there's this connection. So I think that's what makes it really cool.
I think the connection to me is like, let's see if I can come up with the right words. How about musicality, intelligence, and phrasing?
Okay. I like all those three things.
You don't have those three things to me. I don't have a lot of interest in your music, you know.
Yeah. I feel the same way. I mean, I think I always gravitate towards music first. Like, if the music doesn't hook me in, you know, the words may be beautiful, but I'm not going to wind up listening to it because, to me, that's poetry that has a musical background. Like, for me, a great song is like this marriage between great lyrics and great music, and the music has to be the thing that connects me to it, you know.
Well, what if you got somebody singing and you go, I can't tell what he's saying?
and
you really can't. There's been how many songs it's been through years, like rock especially, where people didn't even really know what the singer was saying, and one of the worst ones or best ones would be Mick Jagger.
Yeah, well, and that's a perfect
bring
example.
Around on words, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is that for me, and I know that I'm not speaking for anybody but myself, but, like, there are many times that there's a song that I absolutely love, and I don't have one clue about how the lyrics go, you know, because for me it's the music that seeps into my bones. And, you know, again, I don't like bad lyrics, but for me, in when it comes to songs, the music is what's going to capture my soul first. That's the thing that's going to connect me to it.
Okay, now I got such kind of a touchy subject that kind of goes along those lines.
Well, you have 30 seconds, right?
No, we've got a little bit more time because
okay.
I scheduled for a little bit longer than just in case whatever went
okay.
over. Let's see, how can I do this? Let's just say, let's just use the easy word, rap. Music or not? I say not.
I can, this is what I'll say. I'll say that early rap I thought was phenomenal. I loved the early rap. I thought there was like a groove and there were musical hooks that were catchy. I can't say that I listen to modern day rap. It doesn't do it for me. I think, you know, a lot of it, for me as a woman, I find so much of it misogynistic, and that's not attractive to me.
How about misogynistic, intelligence insulting, and repetitive?
Yeah, again, you know, I can't even single out rap. I can just say in general that unless music grabs me and there's got to be some sort of, what's the word? There's just this musical connection that happens. I'm not going to be listening to it. And so I think that in a lot of ways that, you know, rap is not speaking to me because there's, it's not just the repetitiveness of the words, it's the repetitiveness of the groove and the music. Like, it sort of bugs me out. Like, I need to hear a melody that goes somewhere. I can't, it's like, to me, sometimes listening to certain songs is like listening to a shotgun go off over and over again, you know? It's just, it's not speaking to my spirit. It's just sort of attacking my senses.
I get a lot of people wanting me to play their music, rap music, hip-hop, or whatever you want to call it, and I'll listen
mm-hmm.
to it. No offensive language. No, I'm not playing it. You know,
yeah.
They've run out of... I don't understand. If you're a real songwriter, why is the offensive language so vital? I think it's trying to be, like, tougher than the other guy or whatever you want to call
yeah.
it. And
yeah.
it's really
well,
kind
yeah.
of sad way, you know.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't use expletives in my music in general, but if it was appropriate to the song, I wouldn't be adverse to it because, look, you know, we're humans. There's a time and place for everything, and I don't know one person who hasn't dropped a curse word here and there in their lifetime. But as far as using it to posture yourself, yeah, that's just not appealing to me, you know?
When using a hammer on a nail and using a hammer on my head, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yes, I do know what you mean. And I'm all about the love, Ralph. I want everybody to respect one another, and I want to spread good energy. And that doesn't mean that I'm always writing happy songs. Lord knows that's not my MO. I write plenty of sad songs, but I think as a person that my personal mission is to always focus on what's positive and try to find what's good in every single person that I meet. And I think that I want music to do the same, to sort of make us realize how alike we are instead of make us see the differences.
Music, when I was growing up, music was a positive influence, and nowadays it's being used for a lot of negative influence to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the stuff, the rap and the stuff like that with the lyrics. And I just
mm-hmm.
wonder, like, 40 years from now, are they going to be playing that music for their grandkids or whatever and say, hey, listen to this great music we did back when I was... No, they won't want their grandkids listening to that garbage.
Well, and it's not even... Look, I'm not going to sit here and cast judgment on anybody's music because if it makes somebody happy, then that's what makes them happy. But, you know, I had a friend who's a bit younger than me say to me once, well, what's the big deal with the Beatles? Like, why are you, like, so... like, in, you know, so addicted to them. And I said, and I'll tell you why. I said, because my parents listened to the Beatles, and I listened to the Beatles, and you listened to the Beatles, and your kids are going to listen to Beatles, and your kids' kids are going to listen to the Beatles. I think that there is something timeless about what they did musically that will always be relevant, and I think that that's every musician's aspiration is to do something that's timeless, that will be able to sing to generations to come.
You know, and I just wonder, you take, there's a lot of people out there that's got a lot of talent, you know, as well as I do, that never gets a chance to be heard because they're buried under an avalanche of, you know, whatever. They can't get their, find their way through. And I just wonder if, let's just say a Beatles today, they might be buried out there somewhere right now.
Yeah, that's very, very possible. I think that they were exactly the right band at exactly the right time, and I don't know that that's ever going to happen again. I have to be honest. And I'm not saying there's not going to be great music. I'm just saying that there was something I always say that I think that the Beatles were tapped in. That's the best way for me to describe it. I think that they were tapped into something otherworldly that I don't know if it'll ever happen again that way.
Remember,
I think it was,
this is going to really blow your mind, okay? The Beatles came on Ed Sullivan in 1964, and, you know, back then Ed Sullivan was it, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, I was 8 years old, and when I got through watching those Beatles, the next day I went to school, and I said, I'm going to tell you something. Now, listen, this is an 8-year-old kid. I'm going to tell you something. 50 years from now, people are still going to remember the Beatles. You got it?
Yeah. Yeah, and you were right.
I meant it, and guess what? I was right.
You were right. You were definitely right.
I have been told by people high up in the music industry that listen to my show that I have very good ears.
Well, I consider myself very lucky that you have me as a guest on your show tonight.
Well,
I'm honored.
Getting bugs, but at least you know you got good ears listening once, you know.
Yeah,
because,
and I appreciate that very much.
I've done like 750 shows on the Blog Talk music shows, and you can go back and listen to it. Maybe 5% of them might not be quite as good as I wish, but I bet you 95% of them I can sit here and go, I'm proud of that, I'm proud of that. I'm talking about country. I'm talking about gospel. I'm talking about rock. I'm talking about pop. I'm talking about folk music. I'm talking about just about everything except, you know what, I don't like.
Yeah.
But I mean.
Well, yeah, and I was going to say, and I think you just defined your definition of success.
Right. And I mean, you know, my success is, I like to, I mean, it might sound kind of a little strange, but sometimes I just go back and I listen to my old Blog Talk music shows, you know, and I'll something in between the songs like this, the next, this, you know, I'll do the same people, all it's one show with one group, and I'll go through their CD and I'll play the whole CD, and I'll say, here's, that was blank by blank, and here's the next song by blank, and it's blank, and I don't do a lot of flapping my jaws. You know why? Because I want those shows to hold up. You just give people the bare minimum between songs, that way they can listen to the music. They don't want to hear me say nothing but who it is, what it is, and next. You know, maybe 15 seconds between songs. I'm not giving you a weather report and all that kind of stuff that you hear on regular radio that clogs up airwaves, you know. I want it to be different.
Right. Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think that that's why you have the viewers that you have, because they appreciate that.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm actually doing this. It's kind of, I mean, you know, we were talking about my MS earlier, and I think that's part of what drives me on this. This is my legacy.
This is my
once you put it on Blog Talk, unless you go in and physically erase it, it's there forever. And this is my legacy. This is my children's legacy. My grandchild. I got a grandson 10 months old.
Oh,
okay.
Congratulations!
Yeah, that's the only grandchild I've got, and I want them to be able to hear what Grandpa did, whenever they're able to hear it later on, whether I'm here or not.
Yeah. Well, I think that's beautiful.
And I think that's kind of what drives everybody in music. They want to leave some kind of lasting legacy, you know.
Yeah, I can say from my, I mean, I don't have, my husband and I don't have children, so my music is my babies. You know, that is the thing that I am going to leave behind. So I think that in a way that that's why it is so important to me, because I think most people have children to sort of carry on for them, and I don't have that. And I look at my music as the way that I will sort of not just disappear after I go, you know.
Now, wait a minute. That's not quite all the way true. I was watching a video of yours, and you have a little dog on there. You still got him? Rocky?
No, it wasn't my dog, but I do have a cat.
What? Oh,
my cat adores me. I'm the center of my cat's universe.
Oh, okay. Well, I just seen you were on there doing the songs. I think it was House.
It was a house concert, and it was my friend Karen's dog.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
the dog literally planted himself on my feet. It was really kind of sweet, actually.
Yeah. Okay, I just want to play a couple more songs, and which one would you like for me to play next off your CD? Here's a new one.
Let's see. What do I want to hear next? Can we get a little esoteric? Would that be okay?
Okay, go ahead.
I'd really love to play the last track, Would You Still Believe, because that's my husband's favorite, and he's my favorite person, so I'd like to play that song if it's okay.
Okay, let me see if I can find it here.
That's number 12.
Would You Still Believe? Okay, yeah, I got it. Okay, we'll play it right now. Would You Still Believe? Here we go.
Okay.
What if I waited this long, and at the end there is nothing?
Here's the thing about it. I took like what you might call a long hiatus from like December 2013 till August 25th of 2015. And do you want to know something that really made me feel good?
Hmm.
Because I didn't even check my stats for like a year and a half. And I went back and looked, and I was getting like, it doesn't sound like a lot, but I was still getting like 1,200 and 1,500 listeners a month, and that's with no new shows or nothing.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That does sound like a lot.
You know, I still had like 700 shows on there, so, but I mean, I wasn't advertising it, I wasn't pushing it or nothing, you know, on Facebook or any place.
Wow.
It just organically staying alive there, and it made me feel good. As a matter of fact, one day before I came back, I had like 400 listeners in one day, and that really made me feel good. You know, just popped up out of the, you know.
That's awesome.
About that makes me, you know, it kind of gave me I don't know what you would call it. It would be like if you took a long break and you just, I wonder if anybody remembers me, and you went back and found out you sold a million records or something, and you go, wow, they do like me, you know.
Yes, and I've asked that question. I've actually sung about that. Like, you know, will they notice if I don't sing? You know, I think that was actually a line from a song. So, yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like if you ever had some like music that you really loved as a kid or something, or maybe when you 20 years ago and you hadn't listened to it in like 10 years. Or whatever, and you go back, put it on, you listen to it, you go, wow, that's still good. It's even better than I thought it was, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's, I don't know. Like I said, you know, I think music is important. It's not like this tangible thing that you can hold in your hands. I think it's part of the magic, you know. I think it's part of one of the magical things on this planet, and, you know, that's what art does. You know, I always say, like, even with paintings and stuff, you know, like, what defines art as opposed to somebody who just paints some stuff onto a canvas? And for me, it's the painting that stops me that defines it as art. And with music, I think it does the same thing. You know, the music that stops you, the music that makes you slow down for a moment and actually connect and listen, that's the music. That's the magic that we're all seeking in our lives, you know?
And does it, I don't know, I'm not trying to knock anything or anybody, but to me, when I look at my listener sheets and I see listeners from overseas, it just makes me feel a little bit, I don't know, better than the U.S. listeners, because I go, wow, they really went out of their way to listen to my show, you know?
Well, like I said, I think that there's sort of an ideal about art and music that's a little bit different in other countries, and I don't think that it's necessarily impossible here in the States. I think that there are a lot of very passionate music lovers here in the United States. I think probably the difference is the density of the amount of people here. I think that you sort of get outvoted. You know, the radio station is going to play what the corporate structure tells them to play. Whereas in Europe, I think that you have a less dense population, and when you have less density, you have more fluidity. You know what I mean? You have more ability to move around, and I think that that's why it seems like they're more open, because I think that they're sort of trained to be more open, and I think that we're sort of plugged into a very a much quicker paced world that's programmed for us, and so you listen to these same 40 songs on Top 40. Well, people who listen to your radio show are obviously seeking out something different. You know, they're seeking out to hear something new, something that they haven't heard before. And that's the service that you provide. That's how you open up the hearts and minds and ears of people who may not necessarily have ever heard of me or Harriet Schock or any other artist. You know what I mean? And that's what makes this whole experience really special.
But you know what all the overseas listeners like? They like to classic country, they like the singer-songwriters, they don't necessarily like the bang, boom, boom stuff. They like the quieter and more thoughtful music like you do, and Harriet Schock, and the classic country, which has a lot of great lyrics and music in it, you know, but it's not overpowering music, you know.
Right. Well, I'm gonna get a quote from you, you know, so that I can use that and let other people know that Ralph Whatley said this nice thing about me.
Hey, well, so. Ralph also says that you have a lot of overseas listeners right now because most, about 85% of my listeners are overseas. So
well,
you're getting a lot of
bonjour, or bonsoir, and ciao, and guten tag.
A lot of those overseas listeners might be in a market you haven't reached before. How about the Philippines?
Sounds good to me. I don't know how to say hello, but I like the food.
Hey, one thing, those people over there, you talk about music lovers. Those
yeah.
are the best music lovers you'll ever run into. And I'll tell you why, because they live for music. I mean, they literally gets them through their day and their life over
yeah.
there.
Because yeah, yeah.
It's not, they don't live under the most ideal conditions. And they
yeah.
have a lot of, you know, the jobs are hard to find, and what you find don't pay a whole lot. And it's just like
right.
that. They make it from one day to the next with music. And they don't want to be reminded of their problems. They want to be uplifted, and they want something that's nice and relaxing and, you know, doesn't
mm-hmm.
jangle
mm-hmm.
their nerves at the end of the day, you know.
Yeah, no, and I definitely get that. And it's funny that you say that about overseas, because I've always, you know, like when I was a kid, I think there was like this drive to like be famous and become a famous rock star, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, now that, you know, years into this, my perspective has really changed, and I always laughed to my husband. I said, you know, wouldn't it be perfect if I, like, developed, like, a humongous following in, like, one foreign country, and I could just go there one month out of the year, do all my shows, make my money for the year, and then go back and be an anonymous person and just live a regular, normal life over here.
Right, and I think that's kind of the – I'm not trying to say that you don't want the maximum success, but – you know, with your movie placements and your TV show placements,
mm-hmm.
they don't necessarily know who you are, so you keep your anonymous kind of life where you're not really inundated with people bothering you and stuff. And over the long haul, that might be actually better, a lot better for you than being so-called famous. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I definitely think that. I think that there's a lot to be said about that, because, you know, we idolize fame in this country, and, you know, we have all these reality shows that we watch and stuff, and, you know, there's a price to be paid for fame. You know, you give up your anonymity, you give up your privacy, and you, I think in some ways you give up really authentically knowing whether or not somebody likes you because of you or because of your fame, you know, and at least I can say that for the most part, I know that my friends are my friends because they're my friends. You know, most of my friends came outside of the music, my true friends. And, you know, not that they don't care about my music, but I think that our friendships are based on something outside of just that aspect of who I am, even though it's a big part of me. You know what I mean? But I know that they're really my friends, not because they think I can, like, pay for dinner all the time. You know?
Right. And, you know, the people that are really famous, you know who their best friends are? Animals.
I was going to say they're animals or their manager, maybe. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, stab them in the back, and you know, when they turn around or something.
Yeah.
That's just kind of the way, you know, over a long stretch, you kind of learn, like you say, where's some people start out at, they kind of start out real hot, and then it gets real cold towards the end, you know?
Yeah.
And when I was doing really good in music, I don't know if you've ever heard of these guys. There was a guy in Houston, and you probably have never heard of him. His name is C.L. Milburn, but he wrote some hits back in the 60s and 70s. And he was working with me and a couple other guys, and we were doing music stuff together, and then when I got sick, I mean, I'm not saying nothing bad about the guy, but everybody just kind of walked away, you know, and goes, well, that's it for him. It just kind of got, you know, and it really kind of hurt me a lot, because that was right after I got all that stuff on the radio, TV in Houston and everything, and then it was about 8 or 10 months later I got sick, and then it was just like it vanished, like, who are you, you know? catchable, you know, but that's the way it sounded. It felt like it was catchable. Like I was, it actually felt like, I'll tell you what it felt like. I felt like, I'll tell you what happened to me. Here's a weird story. It's got nothing to do with music, but I had been off work for like 6 months after I got sick. And I called up to the work one day, and I just wanted to talk to somebody that I knew because I was kind of down, you know. So the guy I used to work with 5 years, I was worked with him shoulder to shoulder every day. He answered the phone. He told me his name and everything. I said, hey, how's it going? He goes, who is this? I go, this is Ralph. He goes, Ralph? He goes, we thought you were dead. And he was serious.
Oh gosh. Jeez.
But that'll tell you how to go out. Yeah, right. I mean, you know, that really, that was... That wasn't exactly what I was looking for on that phone call.
No, definitely not. Look, you know, they always say that adversity will show who your real friends are. And your friends who dumped you, I think it says more about them than it does about you. You know what I mean? Like, if they couldn't stand the situation because maybe you were going to need some help or some support, then they weren't real friends to begin with. At least I don't think so. Well, I think your real friends are tried and true.
Weren't the only ones that dumped me. How about the ex of my wife at the time? She said, I'm not sticking around for no wheelchairs. So basically, she eased me out the door. You know what I mean? I'm not going to take care of you 24 hours a day. Well, guess what? I'm walking around 2 miles 5 days a week and doing a lot of other things, plus this radio show. So I don't think I need too much help yet, you know.
No, it's her loss. And let me tell you something. 18 years ago,
I mean, you know, just don't jump the gun too much, folks. You know.
Well, but they're making so much progress with it also. I mean, I have two friends that have MS, and I have actually a family member who has it. And I can tell you that of the three of them, only one really exhibits symptoms at this point. And I think it's because of all of the breakthroughs that they're having with research on the disease. So you hang tight there. I think they're pretty close to the cure.
The only way you could tell if I got MS is if you was able to see through my eyes and the blurriness sometimes, or you saw me after I got hot, and I get hot, I start look at kind of act like I'm a little dizzy and drunk looking, you know.
Sure.
As a normal everyday thing, you wouldn't be able to tell. I call it passing for normal, you know. Normal.
I was going to say, Ralph, aren't we all passing for normal?
Yeah, I think that's what everybody, you know, they always go to the psychiatrist and they go, I just want to be normal. And he goes, normal's whatever is normal for you, you know, that's normal.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know what gets me? And I hate just get down on things like this, but you know, just think, I can remember when I was a kid, and I don't know, I went to Baptist churches when I was a kid, and they told us, under no means, it says in the Bible that races should not mix, there should never be mixed marriages, but under no means should boys and girls swim together in a swimming pool or at a lake, by under no means should girls wear skirts above their knees, by under no, I mean, you know, and all that kind of just went, and when it got out of where people doing it more than not, they kind of just forgot about it. And it's the same thing they're doing now. By under no means should same-sex marriage ever be allowed. By under no means, I mean, think back in the 1800s, by under no means should slaves be free. By under no, you know, it says in the Bible, blah, blah, this and
right.
that, and they keep changing what the Bible says when they get overwhelmed and they get outvoted, as you might call it, they keep changing it. Have you ever noticed that?
Well,
I'm not saying nothing about anybody, but it's just always amazing to me how people use something and hammers it over your head, and then when they start seeing a wind blow the other way, they shift around real quick so they won't be outcasted, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's like, that could take a whole nother night of discussion because I have my own opinions about, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm more of a spiritual person than what you would call a religious person. You know, I don't look to a book to find the truth.
Yeah.
I think that God, you know, God instills in you a sense of right and wrong, and that, you know, like I said, this could get into a very, very, very deep conversation that,
yeah, well,
you know,
there was a,
is
there
way
was
off the track. But.
There was used to be a guy on the radio that I listened to out in California that had, like, this talk show. And he had a saying, he goes, a little bit of religion goes a long way with me.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, and then there are people who say designer religion, like they design it the way it's comfortable
right.
for them. And I kind of feel like, I feel like everybody should be kind to one another. I think that everybody should treat everybody the way they want to be treated. You know what I mean? Like, I do believe in
uh-huh.
do unto others. And I think personally that, like, your relationship with God is an intimate one. And I think that, you know, if church gives you a sense of community or temple gives you a sense of community or, you know, then more power to you. I just don't want anybody to impose their views on anybody else legally. I think that everybody has the right to believe and perceive God or not to believe, you know, as they choose to. I think when they start imposing, you know, their beliefs on others, that's when it becomes problematic, because you're always going to step on somebody's toes because not everybody sees things the same way. And, you know, my feeling is if your actions don't hurt me, don't affect me, then it's none of my darn business, you know? But if you're doing something...
I'll tell you what. There's two governors I'll use for an example. One is Jesse Ventura. You know him?
Sure. He used to be the wrestler.
The other one is Governor Huckabee that was in Arkansas. Okay, Jesse Ventura says, what difference does it make to me if somebody down the street's gay and they're married to same sex? It's not bothering me. And Huckabee
right.
goes and pokes his nose in everybody's business and goes up to Kentucky where that woman's in jail. And when she gets out of jail, he acts like she's the big hero, you know, and all
yeah.
that, because she would give out marriage licenses to people and sits there and goes, the
right.
Supreme Court is not the final say in things in this country. Blah, blah, blah. They have no right to
yeah.
tell people. Okay, well, they had no right to tell people that slavery was outlawed. They had no right to tell people integration was outlawed. Of course, Arkansas, you know, that's where they were famous for. They didn't believe that, and that's when they
right.
got into the Central High School, you know, in Little Rock. That's world famous for what they have there, and that's a shame of Arkansas. They want to keep doing it over and over again. I don't understand it.
Yeah. I don't understand it.
Well, high on every issue that comes along, they want to be the last stand, you know.
Yeah, well, look, you know, I leave room for the possibility that we can all be better versions of ourselves. You know what I'm saying? I think that we grow up not only as people, but we grow up as a society. And, you know, my husband and I both said, I think that the whole fuss about gay marriage nowadays, I think it's going to be the equivalent of how mortified we feel about having had slavery so recent in our history. I think we're going to feel the same way about gay marriage. We're going to look back and go, why did anybody ever care about that? Why was it anybody's business except for the two people entering into a union of marriage? I think that we learn and we grow as a society. We learn that, you know, to look at each other as human beings and to respect one another. You don't have to, you know, if you don't like gay marriage, then don't marry somebody of the same sex. But, you know, if you are going to expect people to treat you with kindness and respect, you have to extend it back to other people. And I think that my personal feeling is I think that people are born straight. I think people are born gay. I think people are born bisexual. I think that's how they come out. I don't think that it's something that's chosen or decided on. I personally believe that every two adults are entitled to love and express their love as they see fit and as is natural for them. And I think that love should be validated by a marriage license. And I don't see anything wrong with gay marriage. I don't understand. You know, I grew up in a household that was much more progressive, so it was never anything that anybody in my household would ever have questioned. But can I then turn around and understand how somebody who's been brought up, you know, in a different religion could find it very threatening? I can understand it. I can understand their fear and their confusion and them thinking it's odd that a man might want to marry a man or that a woman might want to marry a woman. I can understand how that's possible. And all I ask is that, okay, you don't get it, but don't let your not understanding something be overridden by fear, and don't let the fear dictate how you decide other people should live. That's all.
Yeah.
And
Columbus,
I think if we... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, and Columbus was going to sail off the edge of the earth, too.
Well, and again, that could be a whole nother discussion, but I actually have to get going soon, so
okay.
We'll have to save that for another time.
Really great having you on the show. Like I said, it was. I'll tell you what I'll do. Pick another song, and I'll play it for the last thing we do here, so you can have your one last. And maybe you want to give your website again real quick, just in case
somebody
tunes. Yeah,
that's a great idea. Sure.
Okay.
My website is marcigeller.com, and it's spelled MarciGeller.com. And I am debating between, you know what, let's end it on Only Love Matters, since that's what we were kind of talking about anyway. This is a duet that I did with the wonderful David Buskin, and I think it says it all.
Okay, let me find it. Okay, I got it. Okay, well, it's been great having you on the show, and we'll end it with this one, Only Love Matters, and we'll be talking with you soon, I hope.
I hope so, too, Ralph. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, you said something about you wanted me to give you a quote. Are you going to send me something to fill out, or how do you want me to do that, or email you?
No, just email me a quote and a link to the show so I can spread it around and have other people hear it.
Okay, that'll be great. Thanks a lot.
Have a great night.
Here we go with Home Club. Okay, we'll talk to you soon.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Stronger than fear. Let go for this moment.